You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell, and this is The Life Aquatic. A first today for Boat Radio and The Life Aquatic, as we speak to a family hit by catastrophe in the opening days of their adventure. Regina, Alan and their three children, Kaylee, Lily and Anna, were shipwrecked within days of leaving Florida. En route to Guatemala, they were beached in Mexico and ended up, well, I'm going to let Regina tell the story. Welcome to Boat Radio.
Thank you so much. Also, Alan just joined us, so we've got both of us here now.
Ah, perfect. A full compliment. Alan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for joining us. So, Regina, take us back to last fall. You were all excited, I guess, to be heading off on a big adventure, yeah?
Oh, definitely. We had been asked by Alan's dad, my father-in-law, if we wanted to crew with him, because he wanted to do one last big, you know, one big trip, and he wanted to do a circumnavigation, but he knew that he was going to need crew. He knew that he was going to need someone to help, you know, primarily to maintain the boat as well as that. And Alan had done a lot of the work on his boat for him. So we were some of his first, you know, I think we might have even been his first choice of asking if we wanted to, you know, if we were interested. And of course we were, because when somebody comes along and says, hey, by the way, come with me and sail around the world, the answer is yes.
Well, it certainly is. So Alan, what was the plan exactly? Where was your old father's boat?
Well, when everything initially started coming together, he had his boat in Venice Beach, Florida. And so we sailed his boat down to Guatemala.
I
sailed his boat down to Guatemala with him about 6 months before our departure. You know, and then we started doing the boat work to get our boat ready to go. You know, so we went over our entire boat and made all the necessary repairs to try and be safe. You know, and the last thing on my list of priorities was paint, since it has no structural value.
Yeah, I was about to say, and we never got around to that. When we figured, because what our plan was, is we were going to sail our boat from where we were living at the time in Key West down to Guatemala, and then we were going to put our boat in storage while we did this trip, and then when we got back from this trip, we were going to do a complete refit on the boat since it was already hauled out, you know, and get it cleaned up and get it prettied and repainted and all of that, but there was no point in doing that before we left because it's going to be sitting in storage for the next probably 5 years.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the plan was to store the boat for 5 years and come back to a boat that would need a total refit.
Okay.
You know, the bones of our boat were great, but you park a boat for 5 years, you're going to have to rebuild it.
Yeah.
So that was the plan.
Okay. So you're going to sail down to Guatemala
and
then transfer yourselves and your three girls.
Mm-hmm.
Onto his boat, put your boat up on the hard, and then head off around the world in his boat. So you left Key West in Florida, I think October 23rd last year.
No, I think it was actually October 30th.
Okay, so
the kids were so mad.
No, his date's right.
Because, is it?
Yeah, it was 14 days, and we landed on the 5th.
Okay, well, I was about to say, I thought it was closer than that because the kids were so upset about missing Halloween.
Yeah. But no, it was like the 23rd. That's
okay,
we
but, well, it was...
Yeah. We had
dates aside, it should have been a two-week easy passage down to Guatemala for seasoned sailors like yourselves. So, look, Regina, what went wrong? What happened? What was the first sign of trouble?
We had actually expected it to be less than 2 weeks because, in all honesty, it should have been...
I've done the trip in 5 days.
Yeah, it should have been a maximum of 8 days, but we prepared for 2 weeks because you never know what's going to happen. We ended up getting out there, and we started having engine issues.
Yeah.
We ended up having one of our sails rip.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to all of that, the weather was nothing like what we had gotten predicted the first day was.
Yeah.
And then pretty much after the first day, the winds completely fell off, and we started radioing every ship that came by to get an updated weather forecast, and they still gave us the same thing that we had, that we were supposed to have this perfect weather for the passage, but we were becalmed for...
almost a week.
I was about to say, probably about a week, we were nearly becalmed right around Cuba.
Yeah, we were just north of Cuba. And
just north and west.
And it took us about 6 days to get west of Cuba. You know, we were fighting a current, and we were dealing with fickle light winds. And it was really challenging.
In addition, we ended up also having our water tanks fouled.
Yeah. They were iron tanks.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd done my best to clear them out before we left, and I thought I'd done a good enough job, but I was wrong. And on the crossing from Key West to the shore of Cuba, we were doing about 9.5 knots in about a 10-foot sea. And so it just oscillated everything in our tanks and turned the water very brown.
And foul tasting.
It tasted kind of muddy.
Metallic and muddy. But we did have a couple of jerry cans of water too, so that's what we switched over and started collecting rainwater.
Yeah.
But that was slightly stressful.
Yeah, we had the stress of the fresh water. You know, we tore the foresail up at the top, and it was a section that I had suspected of being weak, and I had talked to a local sailmaker about it, and he had said that, you know, yeah, they were a little weak, but it should get us there, and so we went with it. You know, the biggest frustration I had in hindsight was that I spent money working on rebuilding and replacing the engine, and I really wish I had just bought a couple of more sails and said the hell with the engine from the jump. You know, if we had just decided to be engineless, I would have pulled the propeller, so we wouldn't have had that drag. The boat would have pointed about 5 degrees closer to the wind.
But unfortunately for us, that's hindsight, and we were going down there thinking we don't know what we're going to get into. We've already got sails that we've been have been looked at and been told that we're all in all fine for the trip we were doing. So we focused on the engine, and like I said, it messed up on us like pretty much shortly after the jump.
I think you can't be blamed for the things that went wrong. You know, a professional sailmaker told you that your sails were fine for the short 5 to 8 day passage, and you it was unlucky with the water tanks, and you decided to work on the engine and something went wrong, you know. But I think I've looked at your website, which is great, by the way. It's a really, really good website, Krakenkist Adventures. Now, I would urge anyone listening to take a look at it, krakenkist.com. And the first of your videos, the first episode of what is to be a documentary series, I mean, it's gripping stuff. It really is. And do you know what? I have a bit of a problem with it. My problem with it is that it does you guys a bit of an injustice, I think. I think you've been a little bit too modest in it, because it makes you look kind of like a little bit amateurish, and like you've sort of bungled your way into this sort of disaster, which is absolutely not the case at all, because we should make it very clear to everybody listening that you guys are really seasoned sailors. You really know what you're doing. You've been living on boats for 2 decades, and you sailed this passage many times. And
I was about to say, and not only that, Alan was a professional sailor aboard a schooner for a couple of years, and in all honesty, when we ended up going back to Key West, would have still been if the boat that he was working on would have still been going, because we love that boat. The captain loves us. And
yeah, I was first mate on the Western Union in Key West. So for the better part of a year.
So he was out sailing every day. And while he was out doing that, because this is when the girls were tiny, the two older girls were about three and five.
Yeah.
And I actually, when Alan would sometimes go out sailing, we'd have the occasional, like once or twice a month, I would end up taking our two little kids out sailing on our boat, and we'd end up like doing drive-bys of Alan at work on his boat and waving to all the tourists.
Yeah.
So that was me handling a 32-foot boat with two little kids. And
yeah.
So yeah, we've definitely got
Yeah, Regina,
a reasonable amount of experience.
Regina, you are people who know what you're doing. You know what you're doing. Can we just, Alan, before you carry on, how old are the girls? And have they lived their entire lives, essentially, on a boat?
Okay, Kaylee, the oldest, turns 18 the end of November. And she was a year old when we bought our first boat and moved aboard. And she learned how to walk on that boat. Lily is going to turn 16 in January. And she came home from the hospital to that boat and made it too small. And then Anna, our three-year-old, was actually born on our schooner at the dock.
The one that we shipwrecked in Maine.
Yeah, on the dock in Maine with about 10 inches of snow on the ground.
Yeah, I was going to say, just after a blizzard.
And it was 10 degrees outside the day she was born. And it was 85 degrees in the boat. We had a Dickinson Atlantic diesel stove. We were always warm in Maine.
So 10 degrees, that's 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
Whoa, that's really cold. That's incredibly cold.
I was born in Chicago, and in Chicago, Illinois, we get... winters are commonly, you have long stretches where it's 10 below Fahrenheit.
Yeah, I understand. You get ice on your eyeballs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, God, yeah.
and I've been far enough north in America in the winter that I've been where you can spit, and before your spit hits the ground, it'll be frozen. Yeah. So, yeah.
Wow. That's cold.
I love the weather here in Roatan. It's neither hot nor cold. It's perfect.
Okay, so let's pick up the story again with Regina. If I could just... ask you to tell us, you left Key West.
Yep.
You were in the doldrums, you had engine trouble, you got problems with your water tanks, but you are seasoned sailors and you'd brought jerry cans of water, so you had plenty of water. You were fine for water, even though the main tanks were fouled. So what happened next? Then the bad weather hit you, right?
I was about to say, we ended up, it wasn't even bad weather. We finally got a little bit of a breeze and we were trying to work it for everything that it was worth.
A little bit. By a little bit of a breeze. All right. We finally had a day where we got 20 knots of wind.
No, it was before that. We were just starting to get little bits of it, and we were trying to work it, we were trying to work it at first west. So when we got the little bit and we were able to go west, it's like, let's just go with it. We need to get west and get around Cuba.
Yeah, we got around Cuba.
We got around Cuba, and it's kind of like, okay, well, now we need to turn south.
Right.
And the wind started picking up, which was lovely, except it was coming from the southeast.
It was coming from the southeast. Our course was a bit west of what we wanted. I had probably 7.5 or 8 knots of boat speed through the water, and we were making 2 knots good. And we were looking at another 9 days at sea trying to get to Guatemala, and everybody was tired. And, you know, we had the various situations we had, and Isla Mujeres was 300 miles away. And I'd been there a few times. I knew the anchorage. I knew the entrance. We had decent charts for it. But, you know, I felt really comfortable going there. But we talked about it, and we decided that we would turn and we would run for Isla Mujeres.
Well, also, we were running longer than we had thought, because we thought by the time...
We'd already been out for a week.
Yeah, we were making the decision. We were already ending the end of, you know, when people were, you know, close to when people were expecting us to be there. So we were at a point where we wanted to get somewhere so that we could let people know, this is what happened, we're okay, stop there, like reprovision, message everyone, let them know we were safe before we continued on to head south.
Right.
Before you continue with the story, I should explain that Isla Mujeres, I hope I'm getting this right, it's a small island group off the coast of Mexico, not too far from, I suppose, Cancun would be the biggest well-known.
It's within sight of Cancun.
Yeah, it's one island, and it's just like, it's within sight of Cancun. So it's basically Cancun.
Yeah. It's literally a 15-minute ferry ride from Cancun.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's where we were headed, and it was about 300 miles away from our position. For the listeners that are familiar with the area and the conditions, we didn't actually point ourselves at Isla Mujeres. We had the Yucatan Current pushing us north-northwest at a significant speed, sometimes as much as 4 knots. So we actually were aimed for Ambergris Key, or Ambergris Cay in Belize. That's what the boat was pointed at as we crossed the Yucatan Current for Isla Mujeres. We had a lovely crossing with excellent boat speed and good, you know, ground coverage. We were making about 4.5 knots towards Isla, and we got, I guess we got about 30, 35 miles away, and the wind died and shifted to be a bit more from the south. And we got pushed to just north of Isla Cantoy, which is a tiny little island. It's a barrier island about 10 miles north of Isla Mujeres. We anchored there for a night and a day. We were boarded by the Mexican Navy. They sent a man over who speaks better English than I do, and we discussed the entire situation.
Over, yeah, I was about to say, they went over what we were doing. And
they vaguely searched the boat. They, you know, just basically checked in on us. And we talked about weather.
I was about to say, and we made sure, once again, since we had been getting weather from everyone that...
We got weather from them, too.
We got weather from them, and they said, yeah, we don't have any wind today, but it should pick up tomorrow.
And you should nothing to worry about.
Nothing to worry about. You should be fine to be able to get down to Isla Mujeres tomorrow.
So the next day, the wind starts, you know, to come up early in the morning. We get the hooks up. We start making way. And it's a battle. It's a battle for every inch of ground.
Yeah, I was about to say, it was a different direction than we were told.
We've got Isla Cantoy is not north-south. It's got a slight cock
where
the northern
diagonal tip
is to the west and the southern tip is a bit to the east. And the current, the Yucatan Current, actually comes up and is effective less than a mile off of Isla Cantoy. And I know that for a fact, because we sailed a lot closer than a mile off of Isla Cantoy, and we're still fighting that current. So we clawed our way south, and we clawed our way south, and the wind was coming from a direction that was just barely east enough for us to make south. And I had a quarter mile spot on the charts where I had limited information. You know, here's where the deep water is, here's where the shallow water is, and from here to what is shown on the chart as dry land, the depth is 0 to 16 feet. And no detail, except I know I'm on the ocean side of a reef with, you know, a shallow lead up to it. So I know that I've got a good shot of having coral heads. I know that I've got a good shot of having reefs all on this quarter mile section that I can't really get detail in. The one bit of detail that it had was this large green blob about a mile off of what was supposed to be land, where it had zero depth on the chart. And I know that the charts in that area are offset by a couple of hundred yards. We were going to clear that green blob by about 1,000 yards on the chart. We were making about a knot and a half, 2 knots boat speed. The wind was maybe 5 knots, mostly from the east, but with a bit of south in it as well. And we were maybe a quarter of a mile from where we could make our turn and actually sail safely over the reef and into Isla Mujeres Harbor. And the wind died and shifted and came from the southeast.
Let's also point out that by the time we were doing this...
This is also at like 2:30 or 3 in the morning, and I've been up for 18 hours.
Really, really late. And at this point, everything was touch and go enough that we weren't really letting the kids do watches because like the weather was being so hinky and it was being so hard to sail.
The fact of the matter was
the
only person who was on the boat who was competent in dealing with the sails on that boat in light air was me.
Yeah.
And I could get every bit that that boat was going to give, and it was a skill that I had that I hadn't been able to pass on to anybody else. So all day, all that day, I sailed the boat, I trimmed the sails all day. I was exhausted. Regina would spell me at the helm when she could, but
I was also taking care of a little person.
We were all exhausted at that point.
Yeah.
And so the wind shifts. It's too dark to see any water indications of a shoal. The conditions are too mild for there to be enough of a wave train coming through for there to be sound of breaking water to warn us of a shoal. So I decided that since, you know, we didn't have any weather to worry about, just this light fluky air, we'd go ahead and anchor behind that shoal. So we jibed out of the tight spot we were in, and we sailed around behind that marked shoal, and I was casting our lead line the whole way, making sure we didn't have anything in front of us, and we got to a spot that looked good. The boat was in about 16 feet of water. We figured that we were going to be there for a couple hours until the wind shifted. I threw down our 60-pound fisherman on 100-foot of 3/8 chain and gave it another 50 feet of 1-inch 3-strand, and we sat on that. About 2 hours after we dropped the hook, the first squall came through. And then
which, like I said, we had no indication of after having talked to the Navy that
right.
had come by. They had given us no warning that there was any kind of expected storms or anything.
We had no information of any weather instability or anything like that from the Navy the day before. If I had had any inkling that conditions were even conducive to a tropical storm, I would have kept sailing. I would have said to hell with it. You know, if we're going to run aground, we'll run aground and I'll deal with it in the morning, you know, or something like that. I mean, we would have pushed on. So the first squall came through and then it was just a chain and, you know, we went to bed. And that night was fine. I had to get up in the middle of the night and lash the helm to one side to keep us bow into the waves. The next morning, conditions had deteriorated more. We had a pretty sustained east-southeast wind. Running about 30 knots. We were dealing with probably 6 to 8 foot swells coming through there. And they weren't breaking. They were starting to peak up a bit, but they weren't breaking. Not by a long shot. And we continued to sit there on that one hook that whole day in those conditions as they worsened. And I was up on deck frequently checking the gear, looking for chafe. You know, at one point during that first full storm day, I had a little bit of chafe on the anchor. And so I brought out some more chafe gear and, you know, made some adjustments and stuff like that. And we had no more chafe.
Regina, can I just cut in there? What were you doing with the kids at this point? Are you just, like, sitting doing jigsaws and, I don't know, watching videos or...
Yeah, basically, we were twiddling our thumbs waiting.
Yeah.
You know, just trying to keep, you know, teenagers were entertaining themselves doing what teenagers do. And, yeah, we were, you know, Anna was...
Two.
So, you know, I mean, we were doing whatever we could to, you know, keep her entertained with between different shows, although we were trying to be cautious about our power usage because we were at that point running low on gasoline.
Yeah.
We were all trying to keep an eye out because the Navy had told us that they were going to be out over the next few days. And if we needed anything to call them, and we tried calling them on the radio to see if, you know.
Yeah, I was on the radio all of that day. Trying to get a hold of somebody just to come give us a tow.
You know, if we could get out of that area that, you know, that little tucked in area that we had gone into for the night, then we'd have been
be
able
golden.
To, you know, to make it out and get where we needed to get. But
Yeah.
And the engine trouble, I mean, the engine, you couldn't run the engine at this point, but you did have a gas generator, right?
Yeah, we had two gas generators, actually. We had a backup and we had about a 200 watt solar array.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we had enough power that we could run the essentials. But, you know, Anna, being a two-year-old, is a lot. You know, she liked to watch movies and stuff like that on the computer. And a computer eats a lot of power. So we cut back on any extra energy usage. But it's not like we were in dire straits with that.
No.
And the biggest problem we had was that we had a mile to dry land, according to the chart. It was actually a submerged reef. Even at low tide most of the time. But, you know, we had that a mile away. I had, 8 to 10 footers by that point pushing at us, and I had a sustained 30-knot wind blowing me, you know, towards that shore. And there was no way in those conditions that I was going to be able to get the anchor up and sail us out of there.
And we figured it was going to be waiting another day or so until it blows through.
And then that afternoon, I heard something in Spanish that sounded really official on the radio. And I later found out that was the port captain of Isla Mujeres closing the port and announcing the tropical storm. But by that point, you know, it was already too late. There was already a tropical storm there, basically, and building.
And nothing we could do.
So, you know,
except for sit there and
wait
it out,
and
which
so,
is... we're doing.
So that night at around 8 o'clock, I'm up on deck doing another inspection, and it occurs to me that I'm going to be really embarrassed if, you know, we drag the one anchor and go over the reef with our big anchor in the bow, you know, sitting in the cathead. So I put the big anchor down, and that was a 150-pound fisherman on about 30 feet of half-inch chain and 300 feet of three-strand, 1-inch. And I put it out on about I put it out on about 120 feet total. And, you know, watched how the boat was riding and went to bed. And 4 hours later at midnight, the boat slammed into the reef going probably 6.5-7 knots. I've been in car accidents, you know. This was the biggest impact I've ever experienced. You know, the entire world jumped 3 feet in the air and then slammed into the ground. And, you know, I yelled, "Oh, shit," and jumped for the companionway and threw the companionway door open. We were laying on our starboard side with the port side to weather. I threw open the companionway door, and I looked out, and in a flash of lightning, I saw the waves, and they were taller than the cabin top of the boat. And I saw the light that had been about a mile away from us before, around 150 meters away off our stern. And I closed the door, and the boat got picked up and slammed down again, and everything jumped. And then the next one hit, and the next one, and the next one. And I could tell each time that we were being picked up and moved and carried farther onto this rock. But I also could tell that nothing major was happening to the boat.
This is a tough old boat we're talking about, right? This is a steel-hulled boat.
Yeah. A steel-hulled boat. And I had had the boat ultrasounded in Maine when we had it. And the bottom plating from the chine down was a quarter-inch steel. The keel was half-inch steel. And the topsides were 5/16. Okay? So
it was big and heavy.
It was 30,000 pounds of steel with a bilge full of concrete and steel. And that's what the boat was. And so we hit the reef, and I'm listening for sounds.
And thank goodness, because if we had been in...
If we'd been in a wooden boat, we would have been splinters on the first impact.
If fiberglass boat, we'd have popped, you know, cracked it.
If we'd been in our west sail with her 5-foot keel, we would have been stuck on the reef and beaten into dust. You know? But we were in a steel boat, and she wasn't making any noises of real stress. I mean, yes, she was hitting this rock, but there was no tearing steel. There was no running water. There was no snapping of anything. We're just hitting. And I heard that. I could tell that that was going on. And it was probably, 10 or 12 impacts on the reef. All of them big, gigantic hammer hits. It felt like the boat was getting picked up to her mastheads and dropped. And then suddenly everything's quiet, and we're floating. And I ripped the floorboards up, and I'm looking for water coming in, and there's nothing. We're fine. Nothing's moving.
Meanwhile, I was checking with the kids at that point, because Alan and I had been, you know, and the baby had ended up sleeping out in the living room, because we were regularly getting up and checking, you know, making sure that everything was okay through the entire night. So we had slept in the living room. I ended up going back to the, you know, calling back to the bedroom while he was checking the bilge, you know, make sure the teens were okay.
Yeah.
And they were fine but terrified, because it woke them up too. Actually, I believe it threw one of them out.
Kaylee was awake. She was awake.
Yeah, I was about to say.
I
believe it like threw her out of bed and across her stateroom.
Yeah, but she was.
She was okay. But
yeah, so Regina
scared.
Checked on the family, and I checked on the boat, and I yelled to her that I was going up on deck to get sail up, and she should come out and grab the wheel. And I ran up there and started raising sail, and she ran out and jumped on the wheel and yelled that we had no steering. And I yanked the sail down, and I came running back to the stern, and we had a very ancient, traditional, very proven steering system. You know, the wheel had a shaft behind it. There was a drum on the shaft. Then we had a rope spiraled around that shaft, and one end of that rope went through a block and to an aft-facing rudder on deck, and the other end of that line went through another block and came to the other side of that tiller on deck. And what had happened is that the helm was lashed. We hit the reef, and it ripped one of those blocks and just shattered it into pieces. So the steering was gone. And if we'd had 2 more miles of sea room, I could have fixed it with what I had on the boat, and we could have sailed out of there. But we
only had about a mile.
We had a mile between where we actually hit the water and started floating and the beach.
Yeah.
So by the time that we figured out we had no steering, we had 3/4 of a mile, and that was it. And we were moving at about 3 knots. So we had minutes, but not enough.
So so Alan started shooting flares to see,
if I could see the land.
We didn't even know what shore looked like, whether it was, rocks or whether it was a beach. We had no idea. He's shooting flares, trying to get a look and see what we should prepare for.
Yep.
We were trying to get
everybody's
kids and everything.
In life jackets
we had
point.
Life jackets on. We were trying to get, in case something happened between where we were and the beach, we started running around getting bags ready, saying, okay, if we've got to, abandoned ship, we need to make sure that we've got our ditch bags ready.
Well, we had that.
Yeah.
What we didn't have put together was we didn't have our electronics packed. We didn't have spare shoes packed. We didn't have spare clothes packed. We had our ditch bag. We had our passports together, all our ship's paperwork together. We had our cell phones in there because they had most of our information. We had a ditch bag together. This was about preparing for abandoning the boat in such a way that we're going to get to salvage some of our gear. Now, we had time. So we were using that time to further prepare for what was coming.
And to get dressed.
And as soon as I saw that what we had was a sandy beach to land on with what was then only about a 6-foot swell, because we're on the other side of the reef. We had 6-footers, and they were breaking pretty hard on the beach. But, they were 6-footers. Not a big deal. So once I saw that, then I knew everything was fine. From the time we hit the reef to the time that I saw what was waiting for us on shore, I wasn't sure whether I was going to actually get to save everybody. We had Anna, who was 2, and going into the water in those conditions, even in a life jacket, her chances of survival were small. And I know that if Anna is in danger, Regina's going to spend everything she's got to try and save her. So from the time we hit the reef to the time I saw the beach, I knew there was a really good chance I was going to lose my wife and my youngest. My eldest daughter was in full panic attack mode, and she's not real comfortable in the water anyway. I mean, she knows how to swim, but she's not comfortable. So I knew she was going to be panicky in the water and a danger to herself, and she was going to have to be watched. And then Lily was rock solid. Lily was my trooper. She knew that I was going to be able to get us out of this and that everything was going to be okay. She had total faith in that, and she was going on that. I wish I had the same faith. But I knew that Lily was going to be an asset to me. Lily was going to be able to help me to make sure that the other 3 who were going to be at risk would have a better shot. But I was pretty sure I was going to lose somebody at that point if we went into the water.
Alan, you're a pro sailor, and you've sailed for a long time. It's interesting the way you make that assessment, the way you assess people in that dispassionate way, even though they are your family members. You make an assessment based on the abilities of your crew.
Well, yeah. If you're the captain and you're going to go to sea, you need to be able to assess your crew's abilities.
As I was saying, people's strengths and weaknesses.
I knew leaving Key West that what I had was 2 additional rock-solid helmsmen that could steer me whatever course I told them to steer that the boat was willing to do. Regina is my favorite sailing partner, period, bar none. She's the best helmsman I've ever sailed with. She's the only other person I've sailed with who can listen to the boat and listen to the captain at the same time. It's insane.
And
then Lily,
complimenting me a little much there, but thank you.
Now, Regina does not steer the straightest course, but she does a good job of anticipating gusts. Lily steers a course straighter than GPSs do, straighter than autopilots do. Lily draws a line on the chart. We're doing our interview, honey. There's Anna. Lily steers a course that is straighter than most people can draw with a ruler. And I knew that Kaylee with her ADD, was an inattentive helmsman who, you know, would make sure that the boat didn't hit anything.
We were safe and generally going the right direction, but
really wasn't, you know, going to be paying attention. I knew that that's what I had.
You know, when we're in the more rough situations, we know who to put on watch and who not to put on watch. Whereas, you know, and it's nothing, you know, nothing nasty about anyone. True. It's just this is
you use
how they
strengths.
Handle things.
So let's get back to the story. How hard did you hit that beach?
We hit the reef going 6.5-7 knots, maybe. We hit the beach going about 3.5 knots, and it wasn't a big deal. You know, we came up on the boat was full keeled, okay, for one, and she drew 3.5 feet, you know, roughly a meter. So, you know, her approach up onto the beach really wasn't that big a deal. She slid up there. The waves continued to lift her stern and push her a bit more. We laid gently over to one side, you know, maybe 10 degrees a heel. I went up on deck and watched what was going on with the waves for probably a good half hour to make sure that we were, you know, in a good position and going to be safe. And then we went to bed.
You went to bed?
Yeah, we went to sleep.
It was midnight.
It was like 12:30 when
we
were on the beach.
Woken up.
Yeah.
12:30 in the middle of the night after an insane sail that we were exhausted from. We were up on the beach. There was nothing we could do.
Yeah, there was nothing we could do. So, yeah, we went
to bed. There was nothing we could do till morning. So we went to bed and tried to make it, you know.
And the next morning, I woke up bright and early, probably right after dawn. I don't remember what time it was. But I hopped off the boat onto the beach with a dry bag with photocopies of our passports and the ship's papers and all that. And I went walking. And about 150 yards down the beach was this structure that looked like it was some rich man's hideaway on this otherwise, you know, completely vacant beach in the middle of, you know, nature. And there were two locals there, two young guys, maybe 20, in ripped up clothes and no shoes. And one of them had a machete hanging down to his ankle. And, you know, that's what greeted me on the beach. I went up and I talked to those guys. They didn't speak English, and I didn't have much Spanish at all. But I communicated with them, you know, hey, there's my boat on the beach. Could you get a hold of the authorities? And they called their boss, and their boss came down and called the authorities. And immigration showed up. They brought an ambulance with them and a bunch of police and had plenty of people around who spoke, again, better English than I do. Really friendly, really nice, you know, kept trying to reassure me that there were no problems and that everything would be okay. And then they said, you know, they're going to take us into Cancun and get us checked into the country, and then they'll bring us back out to the boat.
So just to interrupt again, Alan, sorry, it sounds like you've had a really good experience of the Mexican authorities, the Navy, the immigration officials, the medical staff, all that sort of thing. It seems to have been, you know, really a very, very positive experience.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they were fabulous with us, you know.
They could have arrested us. They could have locked us in jail, you know. They could have deported us. They had all the power in the world, and they were wonderful. They really were wonderful in how they handled us. You know, if I had one complaint, it would be that they said they would bring us back to the boat, and they didn't. What they did was they took us into Cancun, and they dropped us off at a hotel. And, you know, I get it. The storm was still there. It was still blowing. And they had gotten me an agent to assist with the whole check-in process of everything and handle all of the headaches of the maze of their paperwork. And he worked for a large marina that serviced sport fishing yachts and stuff like that in Cancun. But he, in his 35 years of working in Cancun, had never heard of anybody going up on the beach there. And didn't have access to any boats that were going to be big enough to get us off, and didn't know where to point me. So because I'd been to Isla Mujeres before, they're like, well, go to Isla Mujeres, talk to the port captain, he'll help you out.
Yeah, I was about to say, when we were asking people, like, we need some help getting the boat off the beach, we basically got a whole bunch of people shrugging their shoulders at us and wishing us good luck.
Yeah, and I was unable to make contact with the people that I had met previously in Isla Mujeres because I didn't have their online contact information. You know, I talked to them in bars and stuff like that when I was down with my dad with his boat. So I talked to the port captain, and he started trying to find me a crew, and he found me a crew, and it took us 4 days to get back to the boat. And by the time we'd gotten back, she'd been stripped. You know, they took the sails, the wheel, the compass. You know, there was crazy stuff. Like, they stole the stove, but the griddle plate that you put the pots on, you know, the grid that keeps the pots off of the actual burners, they left that. That stayed on the boat. They stole the solar panels and left the solar controller. They stole the radio but left the microphone. Untying and unlacing a sheet or a halyard, they would just cut it and take, you know, what was easy to grab. And they came with 14 guys with spears and harpoons.
Yeah, according
to the two men that had met me on the beach.
Yeah, those two men, because we, you know, they told us, you know, they were going to kind of keep an eye on the boat and make sure that it was okay. And, you know, they were, like, very apologetic when the boat had gotten robbed. And they're like, there was nothing, you know, there was nothing they could do, because when 14 guys show up with spears and harpoons and machetes,
yeah,
you know, there's nothing that two guys could do against that.
Especially two guys, you know, well, and what are they going to do for, you know, two for an American family that's washed up on their beach, you know, with more resources in their backpack than those guys have seen in their whole lives. These guys were making 20 pesos a day. That's what they were making. That was around $1.25 at the time. That's how much money they made a day. And they made coffee for us. They were trying to feed us. You know, they went their level best for us.
Shared their cookies with Anna.
Yeah, I'm glad that I wasn't on the boat, because I spent 20 years looking for that boat. And I wouldn't have given her up without a fight. 14 guys or no.
Regina, at this point, so the boat has been stripped, so all the stuff of any value is gone. But, you know, she's still worth something, and she's still your home. So what attempts did you then make to get her back in the water? This probably sounds like a daft question, but I don't know the circumstances of the village or anything. But, I mean, was there even a chance of a crane and a truck for a land rescue or anything like that?
The only thing we really were able to do was try and find boats to pull her off, which Alan pretty much handled.
Yeah.
Because in addition, within a short amount of time of being in Isla Mujeres, I'd actually gotten really, really sick. So I was pretty much in bed and sick the majority of the time that we were in Mexico. We were in Mexico for a month. Well, I think it was like 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks. Looking back, I'm sitting here thinking, you know what, I probably should have gone to the hospital. But at the time, there was just so much going on and so much stress that I didn't even think about it. I was just trying to let Alan get what he needed to get done, because he was going out and talking to crews and trying to figure out what we needed to do to get the boat off the beach. And I was trying to juggle the little people as well as being bedridden and sick.
Thank God for Kaylee and Lily, because they carried a pretty good load then.
Yeah, they helped me a lot with her. They'd take her out for walks and stuff. I pretty much didn't do anything except for cry the whole time we were in Mexico.
Pretty much. We spent about $10,000 U.S. trying to get the boat off.
We made two
serious attempts.
I must say, I think we hired a couple of different crews.
No. We hired one crew and additional people, two different boats.
Oh, okay. Different boats. That's what it was.
I bought water pumps to try and blast the sand away so that we could drag the boat out. We went out there the first time with two boats, one of them with big twin diesel V8s in it. And we were getting somewhere, but the guys kept jamming the suction line of the pumps down into the sand. So the pump had filled with sand and it stopped pumping water. And we'd have to stop and take an hour to take the thing apart and clean it up and get it working again. And they just kept doing that. And honestly, my impression is that they were interested in getting paid, but not interested in getting the boat off. And when we went back the second time, we went back with a bigger boat with a bigger engine. And dragged her across a rock and put a hole in her. And that was it. You know, that was my last shot. You know, if we'd gotten her into the water, even with everything missing, I could have worked out a way to get her to Guatemala and gone ahead with our previous plan.
Or even if we would have had to have put her on hard in Mexico.
And if I'd had to sell her, you know, I had a buyer who was interested. I could have sold her to a really good friend, so she would have stayed in the family and all of that. But yeah, we couldn't get her off the beach. We couldn't save her. She's still there. 2 months ago, a guy got a hold of me who had found her and wanted me to transfer the paperwork to him so he could take her. And we discussed it. And
just haven't heard back from
and
him.
I told him to send me his info and I'd get everything to him, and I haven't heard back.
So she's still there.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
When did you beach? So the end of
we hit the beach on November 5th of last year. That's the day that we hit the beach. So she's been there nearly a year. You see, the thing is where she is, there's not a whole lot of water depth. Your maximum water depth in the area that she's in is about 6 feet. So you can't get anything big back there. The beach that she's on is a property that's been bought by a Spanish development company, that is to say a development company from Spain, and they're getting ready to build condos and, you know, kind of a resort there. Mm-hmm. But their construction doesn't start for another year. So yeah, my guess is that the boat's there, and it'll probably eventually get dragged out and turned into some diving fixture for that resort.
Which is heartbreaking. We love that boat.
Yeah, you know, if I won the lottery today, I would go get her. You know, that boat was the best boat that I ever owned. My favorite boat that I ever sailed. And like I said, I spent 20 years looking for her. You know, I've been in love with gaff schooners since I first saw a gaff schooner, you know, started studying them. Yeah, and then to top it all off, you know, she gave her all to save us. I mean, the dents that she had in her bottom were enormous. She had a dent about the size of a soccer ball, like somebody had taken a soccer ball and jammed it halfway into the side of the boat, kind of a dent, in between a pair of frames. The 1¼-inch through hull for the head is on one side of that dent. You know, it was pushed up more than 4 inches into the hull and didn't let go. You know, and I never got to see what had happened to the keel, but along the chines where we hit the reef, about a 10-foot area was pretty well smashed. We had a 15-ton hammer coming up and down on that steel plate on top of chunks of granite. So, you know, she held together when she didn't have any business holding together.
What an experience. What an experience you've had. Gosh, I wish we could do something about this. I wish we could, maybe there's a listener out there who can help us. I don't know. Maybe there's a listener out there who can help us drag the boat off and get her afloat again. Who knows? Who knows? You never know what might happen from putting your story out on the radio, you know? You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell, and this is The Life Aquatic. I'm talking to Regina and Alan, who, along with their three kids, Kaylee, Lily, and Anna, were shipwrecked near Cancun in Mexico. We're going to make that the end of part one. Do tune in to part two to find out what happened next.